You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. On RadioAryan.com.
Welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, to the Rope Report, Billy's Balkanization broadcast, brought to you once again here on Radio Aryan by the numbers 14 and 88 and by the letter H and by your generous non-tax-deductible contributions through PayPal to roper_billy@yahoo.com. On this week's The Rope Report, in order to explain my perspective and Weltanschauung to the listeners of Radio Aryan, I'm going to not talk exclusively about Balkanization and the coming breakup of the United States of America, but rather about two of the more controversial issues which a man could discuss with his fellow man, those being religion and relationships. But before I do, I'd like to thank you for all the positive feedback and the constructive criticism which we got through YouTube and through the comment and chat functions of Radio Aryan about my previous broadcast, my first broadcast on the Radio Aryan Network. I definitely appreciate your support, your enthusiasm, and your anticipation of my future podcast. And I also want to thank you for your honest constructive criticism. The main areas of improvement where we have an opportunity to better satisfy our listeners seems to be in the clarity and production quality of the intermissions, the songs, and the audio clips which I use in between my soliloquies. That's good, because that means that what I have to say itself is not either too objectionable or too boring for you, but rather that you would like for the production quality of the intermissions and the audio clips to be better. Thankfully, Sven and the other production experts at Radio Aryan have been working with me to produce better quality in terms of clarity and audio of these clips, and helping me to get them lined up so that they can be included in this and future episodes of The Rope Report on Radio Aryan. Please continue to give me that constructive criticism and feedback through the YouTube postings of this broadcast, as well as when it is posted on Radio Aryan in the comment section at the bottom of the page. So, as we continue to strive to improve the production quality of our broadcast, my responsibility on the non-technical end is to make the Rope Reports interesting and entertaining, but most importantly for me, informative for you. I'd like for us to try to help one another understand some of the bigger questions that we all have. And there's really no bigger question that we all have than religion. In the white nationalist movement, you will have a broad plethora of religious and non-religious and anti-religious viewpoints expressed. And that's natural, and that's okay, because to a large degree that reflects American society as a whole. Oy vey. Oy vey. Oy vey. Oy vey. Most people where I live in the South are still religious. They are at least nominally Christian, and as a majority, that's true for the rest of the nation as a whole as well. And that's why I feel that religions or non-religious viewpoints that are anti-Christian are not going to be successful in the United States of America. I can't speak from my personal experience about their efficacy in Europe, but I can tell you that it's hard enough to try to get people to accept our memes and our ideals and our ideology about white nationalism without creating another additional higher hurdle between us and those whom we're trying to reach. That hurdle being to try to force them to throw away their faith and their beliefs, regardless of how deep or sincerely held they might be. Even if they're just surface beliefs, even if they are just cultural icons. Because whenever you ask people to throw away their culture and their religious faith, there's so much of their heritage and their personal traditions and their familial ties tied up in that belief system that it makes them really our enemies, whether they would have been otherwise or not. That is why it's been so important for the Jews to be able to infiltrate Christianity and, over the last two generations, create some new hybrid monster called Judeo-Christianity, a new false religion that is based on political correctness, multiculturalism, and egalitarianism, combined, unfortunately, with the evangelical Christian belief that Jews are actually God's chosen people. Before I get off into the deep weeds about what my beliefs are and how that contrasts with Judeo-Christianity, I'd like to speak about some other people's beliefs. I believe that I can really understand different perspectives and different worldviews on religion because I was raised as a Southern Baptist. However, I became apostate when I was a teenager because of the hypocrisy I observed in the evangelical Christian churches. Really, the contrast between the reality that I observed going on in the world, the collective group behavior of Jews, and the fact that I was told that I could not criticize them collectively because they were, quote-unquote, God's chosen people. And therefore, they could get away with everything, literally with murder, with rape, with running the porn industry, with pushing for abortion, for pushing feminism and the Equal Rights Amendment, for pushing civil rights, for pushing for open borders and uncontrolled non-white immigration into our country, for pushing for gay rights and the entire counterculture movement. Everything which was destructive of Western civilization and my white race was headed up by Jews, and I observed that as a teenager, but then I was told that I could not name the Jew. I could not openly criticize them collectively because, as the Bible says, I will curse them that curse thee and bless them that bless thee. Well, let's look at that. Since 1948, since Israel's been formed, since the United States actually destroyed their greatest enemy right before then, and has been carrying a lot of water for Israel, fighting their wars for them as their bully boys and as their policemen, financing them $6 trillion a year, paying for their defense budget and providing them with top-of-the-line military-grade weapons that they couldn't steal through their Jewish spies from us, and overlooking everything they do to their neighbors and to others throughout the region and around the world. In the United Nations and everywhere else diplomatically, the United States has always had Israel's back since its inception and creation. And while we may say that Israel is our greatest ally, the reality is it's the other way around. We are their bully boy, and they know it. And one of the main reasons why we are is because they, of course, control the mainstream media, the news, entertainment media, as any of the host of radio programs on Radio Aryan could demonstrate for you, are demonstrably controlled by Jews. The news entertainment media is Jewish owned and operated almost wholly. That media control gives Jews incredible influence in the electoral process, and all politicians know that they cannot be elected to public office without the approval of the Jews who control the media. That's just how elections happen, even if they were fair and open and honest, which they are not. Ask Diebold. In addition to their control of the media and that incredible influence it gives them over politicians, the control of the media makes sure that they actually can kill or elevate any politician by beginning or ending his career through the media. They can spin issues, and people's belief systems can be turned upside down and topsy-turvy as they are led to believe that, well, the majority of people believe A, therefore I should believe A to be in the majority and not to be a freak, fringe, lunatic. Therefore, through the bandwagon effect, people want to be in the consensus. Most females of both genders want to be in the majority. They do not want to have unpopular political views and to be the odd person out. They want to believe that they are just like everyone else and that other people believe like they do. It's the difference between sociopathy and psychopathy. And that is a huge difference, let me tell you. So the Jews control the media. They, through the media, control politicians, and they, through the media, control the electorate to make sure that their politicians, their approved politicians, get elected. Their approved referendums get passed, or if they don't get passed, then the decisions of the electorate which go against the Jewish interest are just nullified by the appointed judges in the state or even the federal level of Supreme Court, as has happened in every case when people had an opportunity in every state, including California, to vote on whether or not to have gay marriage. It failed every single time, but the Supreme Court still made the law of the land regardless, didn't they? What this means is that the Jewish control of the media and of our political system and our electoral process, that we cannot provide for the existence of our people and a future for white children unless we remove the Jews. However, mainstream Protestant Christianity, what we today call Judeo-Christianity, supports Jews by giving them camouflage and cover and a shield and making sure that the congregants never criticize the Jews. As a matter of fact, it turns them into more rabid Zionists than the Jews themselves are. So you have people like former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee from my state. Now, I'll be honest with you. In 1992, when I was in College Republicans, I worked for Mike Huckabee on his first U.S. Senate campaign, and he lost. It was my first experience in a political campaign. He was running because he thought that he was enough of a Zionist to win. He wasn't quite elevated enough. A few years later, he was allowed to be elected governor. When he was governor, I worked strongly against him because I had become more red-pilled and radicalized by that time and understood more who our real enemies were. When Mike Huckabee was governor, I worked against him because he supported illegal immigrants having in-state taxpayer-supported college tuition in Arkansas universities, and he wanted to encourage an increased guest worker program sponsored by Walmart and Tyson Foods to bring in more illegal Salvadorans and Mexicans into the state. Literally, Tyson Foods drives buses down to the Rio Grande River, picks up busloads of illegal immigrants, and brings them back to Arkansas, where they put them up in company-provided housing apartments, make sure that they have legal representation for when they inevitably have to go to court for DUI or drug possession or beating their wives, and then hides them from INS whenever they raid their chicken factories, which always somehow get a call the night before to warn them that a third shift shouldn't show up because second shift is when INS is showing up. These issues about Zionists reflect their true psychological illness. Mike Huckabee is the kind of guy who, when he was president of the Arkansas State Baptist Convention, gave a speech saying that because of our white people's collective sins against blacks during slavery, we owed it to Hispanics to be especially gracious and welcoming to try to make up for that. He's what in the medieval era would have been called a flagellant. He wanted to whip himself to make up for some imagined sin. And he still has that same kind of Zionist mentality. I can't even count the number of times he's been to Israel. But Mike Huckabee is one example of a Southern Zionist Christian, an evangelical, who truly believes that the Jews are God's chosen people, as I did myself until I was a teenager. That problem still exists for not only the Southern Baptist Convention, as we saw this year, when they disavowed the alt-right, disavowed the Confederate flag, have a black president already, and stated that even though they're going to continue to have Asian and Hispanic and African-American subgroups within their convention, they were disavowing identity politics. But that's not just a problem for Southern Baptists. Methodists are even more liberal from the get-go, as are, of course, Episcopalians, which are a branch of the Anglican Church, and Unitarians, Assembly of God, Church of God, Church of Christ, Presbyterian. People say that the white nationalist movement has a lot of infighting. I'm a Christian identist, and I'll explain a little bit more about that in a few minutes, but people say that within Christian identity as a faith, there's a lot of infighting, and it's true. But the reality is, that is our people's nature. That has always been our people's nature. There's nothing wrong with the white nationalist movement that really can be pointed out by the fact there's infighting. It's natural selection. It's how the cream rises to the top, through competition. If you don't believe it, drive through any medium-sized southern or midwestern town. The largest, nicest buildings in town will be the churches, and there'll be one on every corner, and there'll be at least 10 or 12 different denominations of Christianity represented by those different churches in each town. So much so that you will wonder to yourself, literally, how they even find enough people to fill the pews of those churches. If there's that much competition, you'll have a missionary Baptist and a free will Baptist and a first Baptist and a general Baptist and a primitive Baptist and a second Baptist. And all these churches are pretty much on the cusp of believing that the next church over, a block away, are going to be lucky to even make it into heaven. They might be damned to hell because of this or that, from our perspective, minuscule disagreements on doctrine and faith. So if that is the case within mainstream Protestant Christianity, which is not by definition a fringe political or religious viewpoint, it's no surprise whatsoever that there's infighting and disagreements within white nationalism or within Christian identity. One of the largest growing faiths within white nationalism today is Orthodox Christianity. And it's only been the last couple of years that there's been an explosion of growth of Orthodoxy. I'd like to address that for just a minute. Now, obviously, its track record, its history, is very solid, compared certainly to the Roman Catholic Church, even though some traditional Catholics are still racially conscious. Mel Gibson and his family, for example, represent traditional Catholics, and there are many others. Not all Catholics have embraced liberation theology. Not all Catholics are even universalist, as the name implies. But like Protestants, many Catholics have been cucked. Many Catholics have been brainwashed with Zionism to a degree, and I think that Pope Francis is an excellent example of that, of a liberal, pro-open borders, pro-immigration, anti-white Catholic Pope. And many Catholics will follow the lead of the Pope, especially in Europe, even more so than in the United States, regardless of what that Pope says. The Slavic-dominated Orthodox Church, emanating from Eastern Europe, not just from Russia, but from all Eastern European countries. There's a Polish and Bulgarian and Greek Orthodox churches. They are ethnic in the sense that each of those ethnic Orthodox churches carry forward some of the heritage and tradition and culture of those ethnicities and the nations from which they sprung. And sometimes that heritage and that culture means that in ethnic communities of those populations, of those nationalities, here in the United States, there's a sense, if you will, of that ethnic nationalism within those elements of the ethnic nationalist Orthodox church congregations, especially in Europe, but also here in the United States. Because of numbers, because of sheer quantity, Orthodoxy is dominated, however, by the Russian Orthodox Church of Eastern Orthodoxy. And that is to be expected. It's always been that way. In the United States of America, as is the case in every aspect of Polish or Italian or Irish American communities becoming amalgamated into the mainstream of American society, those ethnic Orthodox congregations are becoming less ethnic and a little bit less Orthodox, to the point that some Orthodox Christians literally believe, A, that non-whites have souls, which, as a Christian identist, I do not. B, that if an Orthodox Christian of another race wanted to, they could come into your Orthodox congregation and worship with you. And that C, and this is more troubling for a lot of other Christians, including Christian identists, the belief that miscegenation, that is, race mixing, is not a sin. Now, they may hold that it's not a good idea, that it's harmful culturally or even genetically, racially, for a people, but they hold that it's not necessarily a sin because they have glommed onto the universalist view in the New Testament. They misunderstand so much. It's very sad. It's true, you know, that Paul says that there is neither Jew nor Greek, but that's like taking Thomas Jefferson's sentence that they have in the Jefferson Memorial, saying that, you know, there's nothing more certain that these people must be free. The rest of the sentence is that, you know, and being equally free, that whites and blacks cannot live under the same government. But they took off half of that last part of that sentence and tacked it up on the Jefferson Memorial as if that was what he's really saying. It removes the context. In the New Testament, it does say that there will be neither Jew nor Greek, but in the same sentence it says, nor slave nor free, nor male nor female. Now, obviously, men and women are not biologically interchangeable regardless of transsexual belief, even though that's popular and trendy. There aren't 57 genders, not in physical biological reality, and men and women are not biologically equal or interchangeable. So if you believe that the Bible saying there's neither Jew nor Greek means that there's no difference between the races and how they should be treated, or whether they should worship together, or whether they should intermarry, then you also have to say that it shouldn't matter if your daughter becomes a lesbian, because that same sentence says that neither male nor female, right? Shouldn't matter if your son becomes a flaming faggot, because, hey, same sentence says it's either male or female. And this is the contradiction that people get into when they follow propaganda rather than reading God's word for themselves and trying to understand it. And that's why I prefer religious faith, which encourages people to read and try to comprehend it for themselves instead of relying on anyone, a vicar, for example, to vicariously tell them what God's word is and what he meant. That's why I'm so glad that we actually have the Bible in our modern vernacular language, which with proper translation and edification through concordance and dictionaries, we can understand the true original meaning of. So Orthodoxy is a popular, rising religious belief in white nationalism, and I respect it. I do not mean to denigrate it at all. I certainly think that it's probably more racially conscious and more healthy and far superior in every measure that matters to many branches of Catholicism or of Protestant Christianity, including what I was raised in, the Southern Baptist faith. However, it's not without its flaws, just like any religious system. It's, of course, also driven by the idea that the Russians are the good guys preserving traditional values and culture, while we, the United States, are seen as the bad guys promoting liberalism and homosexuality and race mixing. And Russia appears to be more white, more traditional in their values and culture than we are. It's a flip, a reversal of the Cold War, where we are now the evil empire. That's how a lot of white nationalists look at it. And that could be true to an extent, and I'm not faulting that, but taken too far into the extreme, what that leads people to believe is that Russia can do no wrong, and therefore, by extension, everything Russian is good, everything Russian is superior to everything American or Western European, and that leads to Duganism. And I know that a lot of Orthodox Christians do not support Duganism, but a lot of them do. Even a lot of non-Orthodox Christians support Alexander Dugin's view of nationalism and the West. And I've heard some people who I otherwise respect and agree with say that Duganism means that the problem with Western European civilization is that it is too liberal, which I would agree with, and that it has let itself be inundated with non-white immigrants, most of them non-believers, and that I would agree with as well, and that it has shown itself to be weak, and that I would also agree with. But Duganism is a form of Pan-Slavism. Since we've been fighting Pan-Slavism for a century now, since before World War I, which actually kicked it off, Pan-Slavism is now extended through our admiration and respect of Russia into religious faith, which follows orthodoxy, even for those who have no Eastern European ancestry or heritage or culture as far as a tradition in their families or their bloodlines that they're trying to preserve and move forward. It's almost an ideological decision of theirs to adopt Orthodox Christianity in support of Russian nationalism as opposition to liberal Western European and American religious views. And I empathize with that, but I don't think it's anything to base a belief system on. Because in reality, what Dugin says is that he would, like some other leaders have said, prefer a black Orthodox Christian to a white Catholic or a white Protestant or a white atheist. Dugin says that Western Europe deserves to be destroyed and that he looks forward to seeing Western Europe flooded and overran with non-white immigrants because of Western Europeans' liberalism, and that he hates white supremacy. Now, the defense of Duganism when he attacks white supremacy is to say that there is no objective standard for supremacy, and that's a liberal argument. That's a left-wing argument, to say that there's no objective standard for supremacy, so we can't really say that the white race is superior. Well, in any measure that I could think of, my people are. And even if they were not, I would still fight for them to be supreme because they are my people. And it's in my people's interest, in my interest, for me to fight for my people's supremacy. I happen to also believe that, objectively, they are. But the only way to defend Duganism is to eschew objectivity and to pray for subjectivity, to pray for a kind of existential subjectivism and perspectival origin that would do away with concrete definitions of right and wrong. Because the support for Duganism is this. Well, it's wrong to be a white supremacist because there's no objective measure of supremacy. While whites may say that having higher IQs and being creative and inventive and building Western civilization and technology and science and medicine is a great thing, to someone in the Serengeti, carving out a really nice penis gourd is probably the height of their culture, and that's something to really be proud of. So really, that guy who carves a really good penis gourd is just as supreme in his tribe as Galileo or Socrates or Shakespeare were among our people in terms of their relative accomplishments. And since there's no objective measure of supremacy, Dugin is right when he says that white supremacy is wrong. Don't let it end this way. Don't let it end this way. I'm not trying to say that we have to hold non-whites to white standards of behavior or creativeness or inventiveness. We certainly shouldn't. I don't expect non-whites to act like whites. I don't try to treat my dog like he's my kid. I expect him to act like a dog. And I don't get angry that he doesn't act like a human child. I would be confused and upset if he did. Just as I'm confused and upset when people say that they can't define supremacy because there's no objective standard. There are objective standards to right and wrong. From my view, that's what religion is all about. Finding out, aside from subjectivity, aside from different perspectives, what is true, what is real. The real right and the real wrong are not defined and perspectival and subjective. They have always been. My God says that He is the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. He is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and will be the same until the end of time. And what He holds as right has always been the same and will never change. What He holds as wrong has always been the same and will never change. And therefore, what is good is good, what is bad is bad. They've always been diametrically opposed from one another, not encompassing some shady gray area of subjectivity where, based on your perspective, something may be good or something may be bad. That is not a belief system. That's a lack of belief system. That's not a faith. That's a lack of faith. So defending Duganism as an offshoot of Orthodox Christianity by saying that he's correct in saying that white supremacy is wrong because there's no objective measure of supremacy is saying that you don't actually believe in objective truth or objective reality or objective, solid, concrete, non-abstract, right and wrong. I do. And that's why I'm not completely comfortable with orthodoxy, because I don't think that it's a culturally or in terms of heritage and tradition, natural belief system for non-Slavic Americans or non-Slavic Europeans, those who are not of Eastern European ancestry. However, as I said, I certainly respect it. I respect orthodoxy more than I do mainstream Protestantism or mainstream Catholicism, even though within the Catholic Church there are certainly traditional Catholics who are racially conscious and psychologically healthy and have many of our values and beliefs. I'm not trying to force my religious views on others or to judge them for not sharing mine. I'm simply explaining where my perspective comes from in terms of faith. And even in Protestantism, there are different branches of Protestant Christianity which are racially conscious, which are not evangelical in terms of being Judeo-Christian or Zio-Christians. There are Kenist, primitive Christians, who, while they may not share with me my beliefs on the origin of the Jews or even in terms of the dual creation of mankind in Genesis, they do believe in racial segregation and racial separation and, frankly, in racial inequality. They do not believe in miscegenation. And in terms of a religion, that's probably healthy enough to make a healthy, steady society and a great civilization. So I'm not here trying to judge or belittle anyone's religious faith, especially those who are racially conscious, to whatever degree. Nor am I here to judge those who lack a religious faith. I hope that you haven't turned off this broadcast yet, because I'm speaking sincerely to you from the heart. As a person who, after I became apostate as a teenager, was adrift, and for most of my adult life, I was agnostic. I was a non-believer. I dabbled in everything from creativity to Odinism, and eventually, through the help of Pastor Richard Butler of Aryan Nations, found my way back to faith, to Christian identity. So I've been down all those paths, and I understand all of the rationalizations and justifications that non-believers go through to explain away their lack of faith. But I also understand, from a mainstream Christian perspective, how Christian identity looks. And that's why I'd like to take a few minutes to explain Christian identity. If you read Revelations chapter 2, verse 9, or Revelations chapter 3, verse 9, both of them are virtually echoes, and they say that when all of this is done, those who call themselves Jews, but are not, but are liars, but are of the synagogue of Satan, will be revealed, and they will admit that we are God's chosen people. In Genesis chapter 1, Christian identity believes there was first a creation of humankind, parallel and simultaneous with a creation of the other animals, the beasts of the field. And God told them man and woman, that he created them together to be fruitful and multiply and to have dominion over the earth. At the beginning of Genesis chapter 2, God saw that the mankind that he had created, male and female, and told to be fruitful and multiply, had not been successful in having dominion over the planet. It says that there was no one to till the earth. In other words, they had not been elevated enough above the animals to master nature. And so in Genesis chapter 2, God said that he was going to have to try again. He was going to make a special kind of man. He made Adam, and Adam in Hebrew means to be able to blush, to show blood in the face, to have a ruddy complexion, and there's only one race of humankind that can blush, or that you would even notice if they did, and that's whites. And God made Adam, and he did something new, something different. The Bible says that God breathed the spirit into Adam. So unlike the other beasts of the field, unlike the other animals, unlike the previous mankind, the pre-Adamic man that were made, Adam had a spirit, an eternal soul. Therefore, only whites, only descendants of Adam, have souls. And therefore, only whites, according to Christian identity, are capable of salvation, being saved through Jesus' sacrifice on the cross and his resurrection afterwards. And only white people need to be saved, because only white people have souls that could be damned without salvation. Non-whites, pre-Adamic mankind, are beasts of the field without souls. Then Adam saw that there was no helpmate for him. Adam did not miscegenate with the pre-Adamic mankind. He did not want any of those non-white women. So God made a white woman, flesh of his flesh, took from Adam's DNA and made a white woman named Eve for him. And then, yes, they sinned. But the nature of their sin, the nature of Eve's temptation and seduction, was not to eat an apple, as is often depicted. Eve was literally and physically seduced by Satan, and the hidden knowledge was that of sex. And then she shared that hidden knowledge with Adam. And Eve bore twins, but this is a reproductive and scientific fact. I challenge you to look it up. It does happen. Eve bore two sons. Cain was the son of Satan, literally. Abel was the son of Adam, literally. And that explains their different natures. Cain slew Abel and then said, well, I'm not my brother's keeper. And God says, well, now what? Cain says, well, I was afraid that, you know, when you found out, I'd be kicked out. And God says, well, yeah, sure. And Cain says, I was afraid that the people who found me would kill me. Well, who was he afraid would find him? His mom and his dad? Because, according to the mainstream religious interpretation of Genesis, that's the only people that were around, right? No. Cain knew there were other people outside the garden, pre-Adamic mankind. And what happens next? God kicks him out, puts a mark on him so people would not kill him. Cain leaves the Garden of Eden and goes to the land of Nod, where he finds a wife and builds a city. Do you build a city for two people? No. Where did he find his wife from? It doesn't say that he waited 20 years and married one of his sisters that happened to wander around and find him. No, it's not what it says at all. He left then and went to the land of Nod, east of Eden, built a city with the people he found there, and took one of them for his wife. And that establishes two bloodlines, because Adam and Eve then had Seth and other children. The bloodlines descended from Adam, Adamic mankind, the white race, and the bloodlines descended from Cain, literally from Satan. In the New Testament, jumping forward, John chapter 8, verses 44, Jesus tells the Jews to their faces that ye are of your father the devil, you were murderers from the start, referring directly back to Cain and to his father Satan, the serpent in the garden. And then, of course, there were other non-whites from the pre-Adamic whites who were not intermarried with and intermingled with Cain, who made the other non-white races. So Christian identity believes in literal separation of the dual seed lines of Satan and Adam. So all white people have a soul. Only white people have a spirit or a soul that gives them eternal life and the need and the opportunity for salvation. Non-whites are beasts of the field without the need or the opportunity for salvation. Mixed race people, part white and part non-white, we see if you take a vessel of clay and mix it with sand before you fire it, it cannot hold water in the same way that a mixed race person cannot hold that soul. That's dual seed line Christian identity in a nutshell. Another denomination of Christian identity is single seed line Christian identity, which holds that those who call themselves Jews today are descended from the Khazars from southern Russia, a part white and part Turkic people who converted to Judaism in the 5th and 6th centuries, and then they had a diaspora throughout Eastern Europe, and they became the Ashkenazi Jews. And that otherwise follows Christian identity belief, that those whites who have souls and who are also, and this is key, descended from Abraham and his grandson, Jacob, who changed his name to Israel, are the true Israelites of the Bible. And that after the Israelites, descendants of Jacob Israel and his grandfather Abraham, the most special of the most special, because all whites have souls and spirits, but not all whites are God's chosen people, because not all whites are descended from Abraham and Jacob Israel. After Israel was conquered and the Babylonian captivity occurred and Israelites went into the Assyrian bondage, they crossed the Caucasus Mountains, which is why white people are called Caucasians, into Europe and became the progenitors and established much of modern European nations. So the European peoples, to a large degree, are the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel, and then later on the two other tribes. And then their descendants came to the New World, to America. And within Christian identity, there are discussions of what nationalities of Europeans represent what Israelite tribes, but the basic idea is that in single seed line Christian identity, Jews are the descendants of Khazar converts to Judaism, and so they are not descended from Abraham. So they are not, because they're not descended from Abraham, God's chosen people, since they did not have the opportunity to inherit the covenant that God made with Abraham. Because the new covenant in the New Testament is with the same people as the old covenant in the Old Testament. Dual seed line Christian identity holds that those descendants of Abraham, who are also descendants of his grandson, Jacob Israel, are the Israelites of the Bible through the diaspora, but also that the descendants of Cain and the serpent in the garden are the Jews, who are literally evil. Carrying forward into the book of Revelations, where we can flip forward and see how the story wins for us, ultimately, because it wins for God, ultimately. And as long as we are on His side, we will be on the winning side. That is, in a nutshell, Christian identity, single seed line and dual seed line. Like I said, I've been through creativity, I've been through Odinism. You know, Matt Hill is still a friend of mine, and he was a friend of mine before he was incarcerated. I helped edit and publish both of his books. I'm working on the third one. And his mother and I are very close. I do everything I can to help her and to help him. And he and I still write. I write to him in prison. And we talk and joke about our religious differences. You know, I tease him about creativity. You know, I say, hey, Matt, you know, our people are from Northern Europe, where that salubrious living really wouldn't fly because vegetables don't grow for 8 months out of the year there. I'll tease him and I'll say, you know, Matt, you've got a W as part of the symbol of creativity, but you want everyone to speak Latin as a universal language, and there's no W in Latin, so how does that work out? You know, little things like that, just to tease and good nature back and forth. But the reality is, I have friends who are non-believers. I have friends who are agnostic and even atheists. And I have friends who are creators and friends who are Odinist and what have you, and some friends I don't even ask. But they all hopefully know that I'm a Christian identist. And I try to fulfill my responsibility and duty to lovingly and gently, caringly witness to them. So they know what I believe and why I believe it, but I'm not trying to just shove it down their throats. I try to be Christ-like in that regard. And if I fail in that, then that is my own sin and no one else's. So I don't want to be critical of Orthodox Christianity. As I said, I certainly respect it. I don't want to be critical of Catholicism. I also know that there are traditional Catholics whose views I respect. Nor do I want to be overly critical of mainstream Protestant Christians, who I was one of them. So how can I be overly critical of them? Because I understand more than most how they are misled, especially evangelicals like Southern Baptist, as I was. The key is to break them of their misconception that those who call themselves Jews today are God's chosen people. Once they realize that that is not true, then the shackles fall off their wrists, the scales fall from their eyes, and they're free to be racially conscious to a larger degree than ever before. For so many millions of Midwestern and Southern whites in America today who are right there with us racially otherwise, that is all that's lacking. So don't alienate them. Don't make them your enemy. Don't hate Christianity. Don't lump them all together and turn against them. Don't make memes and jokes about Christians. Understand what their misunderstanding is and try to help them through it, as I was helped through it lovingly and caringly by Pastor Richard Butler and then later by Pastor Thomas Robb, who helped me to become a person of faith once again as a Christian identist. You can do the same for other Christians under your influence. For some, it may be easier to use single seed line Christian identity and explain to them logically that DNA and genetic research proves that those who Ashkenazi Jews call themselves Jews today are not descended from the Israelites of the Bible. Linguistic studies of Yiddish compared to German and other Eastern European languages shows that their origin is not from that area. So you could use single seed line Christian identity. It's a little bit less of a leap of faith, frankly, than to believe in dual seed line Christian identity, which requires more of a suspension of disbelief to believe that, you know, Eve and the serpent had sex and that's where Cain came from and that he is the ancestor of all the Jews. If they have to take those baby steps and have the milk before they're ready for the meat and crawl before they can walk, before they can run, then that's fine as their spiritual growth continues. But as a person of faith, and I'm speaking specifically to those of you who are Christians and listening to my podcast, you can reach out to mainstream Judeo-Christians, those who are Protestant or Catholic, it doesn't matter, and explain to them that those who call themselves Jews today are not God's chosen people. And if you have to use single seed line Christian identity to break that to them and then radicalize them to red pill them further later on into dual seed line Christian identity, then that's fine. Whatever it takes, all for the greater glory of God and expanding His kingdom and bringing about His victory. I hope that this program, speaking exclusively about Christian identity, has not alienated anyone. I hope that I have been successful in expressing that I'm not trying to be critical of any other religious faith or any other person's non-religious faith. I'm just trying to explain my own perspective and what I think is crucial for people to know. Do not make an enemy of Christians, because there are millions of white Christians who are the most conservative subset demographically of any part of the American population, who are racially conscious to a large degree and just need that one misconception freed from to be right there with us in every other regard. White nationalism will not succeed in the United States of America if it makes an enemy of the millions of conservative right-wing whites who are at least nominally Christian. It has a very good chance of succeeding, at least to the degree of having multiple white ethnostates as successors to the United States, if it embraces a racially conscious Christianity in those regions of the Midwest and South specifically, where Christianity is an inseparable part of the culture and heritage and identity of the people.
Oy vey. Oy vey. Oy vey. Oy vey.
All I will say about relationships is that as a Christian, you would be blessed if you found yourself equally yoked with another Christian, so that you do not have that kind of contention in your household. I am very fortunate and blessed that my wife is a Christian identist woman, and she helps strengthen and bolster my faith, and we feed off each other and nurture one another spiritually as well as politically. So in that regard, as a daughter of Eve, to use the name of her Christian Identity Women's Organization, my wife is a wonderful helpmate, God's best gift to me. So men, I encourage you to try to find a mate who shares your values and beliefs, but one that will strengthen them and not hold you back, one that will push you forward when you need it, to encourage you and never drag you down. The most important part of a relationship could be that commonality of purpose, which will transcend any minor squabbles or day-to-day grind arguments or differences, because you are united for the common cause to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. But more than that, as a person of faith, as a couple united in service to the Lord, to serve God, and to expand His kingdom. That is the greatest blessing that any man can have in his relationship. So I encourage you to seek out those Christians who need your leadership, your education, and your edification to understand that those who call themselves Jews today are not God's chosen people. If you have any questions about how you can minister and witness to them, as I've done, if I may say so, successfully many times, then I encourage you to email me at roper_billy@yahoo.com. That's roper_billy@yahoo.com. And you can also write to me, P.O. Box 1937, Mountain View, Arkansas, 72560. In closing, within the white nationalist movement today, and especially within the alt-right, for millennials and for those who call themselves white nationalism 2.0, there's a great desire for unity, a great desire for bringing together libertarians and the alt-right and white nationalist in a great big tent, multi-organizational coalition designed to strengthen our numbers through quantity rather than quality, and through this big tent to somehow create a counterculture and a new political firestorm so that we can vote our way out of this mess. Unfortunately, that is not a recipe for success. It's been tried before and failed every time. So in closing, I would like to allow a special guest speaker on the Roper Report to describe for you the pitfalls and dangers of the concept of unity and the big tent approach. Please continue to send in the encouraging feedback and the constructive criticism about this and future podcast of the Roper Report here on Radio Aryan. And as always, this is Billy Roper for the Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Broadcast, reminding you to think racially, act locally, but no matter what, keep it white.
The future of a movement is determined by the devotion and even intolerance with which its members fight for their cause. They must feel convinced that their cause alone is just, and they must carry it through to success as against other similar organizations in the same field. It is quite erroneous to believe that the strength of a movement must increase if it be combined with other movements of a similar kind. Any expansion resulting from such a combination will, of course, mean an increase in external development, which superficial observers might consider as also an increase of power. But in reality, the movement thus admits outside elements which will subsequently weaken its constitutional vigor. Though it may be said that one movement is identical in character with another, in reality, no such identity exists. If it did exist, then practically there would not be two movements, but only one. And whatever the difference may be, even if it consist only of the measure in which the capabilities of the one set of leaders differ from those of the other. There it is. It is against the natural law of all development to couple dissimilar organisms. Or the law is that the stronger must overcome the weaker. And, through the struggle necessary for such a conquest, increase the constitutional vigor and effective strength of the victor. By amalgamating political organizations that are approximately alike, certain immediate advantages may be gained. But advantages thus gained are bound in the long run to become the cause of internal weaknesses which will make their appearance later on. A movement can become great only if the unhampered development of its internal strength be safeguarded and steadfastly augmented until victory over all its competitors be secured. One may safely say that the strength of a movement and its right to existence can be developed only as long as it remains true to the principle that struggle is a necessary condition of its progress, and that its maximum strength will be reached only as soon as complete victory has been won. Therefore, a movement must not strive to obtain successes that will only be immediate and transitory, but it must show a spirit of uncompromising perseverance in carrying through a long struggle which will secure for it a long period of inner growth. All those movements which owe their expansion to a so-called combination of similar organisms, which means that their external strength is due to a policy of compromise, are like plants whose growth is forced in a hothouse. They shoot up externally, but they lack that inner strength which enables the natural plant to grow into a tree that will withstand the storms of centuries. The greatness of every powerful organization which embodies a creative idea lies in the spirit of religious devotion and intolerance with which it stands out against all others, because it has an ardent faith in its own right. If an idea is right in itself, and, furnished with the fighting weapons I have mentioned, wages war on this earth, then it is invincible, and persecution will only add to its internal strength. The greatness of Christianity did not arise from attempts to make compromises with those philosophical opinions of the ancient world which had some resemblance to its own doctrine, but in the unrelenting and fanatical proclamation and defense of its own teaching. The apparent advance that a movement makes by associating itself with other movements will be easily reached and surpassed by the steady increase of strength which a doctrine and its organization acquires if it remains independent and fights its own cause alone.
Deutschland, die Geil! Deutschland, die Geil! Deutschland, die Geil! Für unseres Reiches Macht!
Can you hear the student band? I think they're getting out of hand. Will you know what happened to those who complain? We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right. Cause the fire outside to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're at a wedding full of clowns, and we'll kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America. Democracy.
listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.